Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Our guest in this edition is Vincent Speranza, a U.S. Army veteran of World War II. Mr. Speranza served in the 101st Airborne Division and was a machine gunner at the Battle of the Bulge. He was also at the center of one of the most memorable and lighthearted moments from that battle that many in Europe thought was just a legend until only a few years ago. Vincent Speranza was born in the Hell's Kitchen section of New York City in 1925. He was 16 years old when he heard about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. He remembers racing home to hear President Roosevelt's speech and his immigrant father's unforgettable response.
December 7, 1941. It was a Sunday. I was a 16-year-old kid in high school. I'm riding my bicycle to a store, and when I got in the store, everything was deathly silent. And I said, "Hey!" And they said, "Shut up! President Roosevelt is speaking. He's saying something about the Japanese and Pearl Harbor." So I jumped on my bike, and I pedaled home quickly. I said, "Pop, quick, put the radio on. The president," he puts the radio on just in time for us to hear, "and a state of war exists between the Japanese Empire and the United States of America, and we will win the ultimate victory, so help us God." For the first time in my life, and all of us, there were four boys and four girls in my family, Pop turned around from the radio with tears in his eyes. He lined up his four sons. Al was only 12. Rocky was 14, I was 16, Joey was 20. Like this, "Boys, pay attention. This country must not fail." Understand, boys? "This country must not fail." He said, "Nowhere in the entire world can a man come here with nothing and look at us today. We have a home and a car and beds, and my children are all being educated."
The enthusiasm for joining the military was sky high in his family and in the neighborhood. In fact, Speranza tried, and failed spectacularly, to enlist before he was eligible.
Right after this incident I told you about, when Pearl Harbor took place, the four of us from the neighborhood let a little hair grow here, and we put on our father's fedoras, and we went down to the recruiting office, and we said to him, "We want to join the Army. We're 18. Recruiting sergeant said, "Get the hell out of here, boys. Come back when you're really 18.
Within days, it was clear the United States would not only be at war with Japan, but also with Germany. And yes, Italy. And Speranza remembers his dad being conflicted about the possibility of his boys fighting against his homeland.
My father, you know, when the time came for me to leave, he said, "Vinny, what if they send you to Italy? All your uncles, your cousins are all..." And I just confronted it. "Pop, listen, they're the enemy. That's the way it is. I just hope I don't have any encounter with them, Pop, we're Americans now. You kept saying it to us 50 million times. We're Americans, and we are loyalty and allegiance to the United States of America."
When he actually enlisted a couple of years later, Speranza quickly learned that while the Army tried to make him think that he had input into his assignment, he actually had none.
When we got into the service, they pretend like they're giving you a choice. They give you a battery of tests. And then an officer said, this was in Camp Shanks, New York, right after I got into the Army. And they sit down with you, an officer sits down with you, and he's got your record, and he says, "Speranza, you did 97 in mechanical aptitude. You like tanks?" I say, "Yeah." "And you did 90 in math. You like artillery?" "Yeah." "And you did..." He goes through a whole litany of things that you were qualified for, then to the big stamp, infantry.
Speranza thought he wanted to be in the infantry anyway, but soon he saw something that quickly made him change his mind.
One day they took us out to a big field, And they said, there's going to be a demonstration today. And we said, what kind of demonstration? They said, shut up and sit down. And we sit down. Three C-47s come out of the sky here. And we see that, you know, paratroopers were brand new. And we see the doors open. We see guys throwing themselves out the door. And a little white thing opened and takes them down to the ground. And they roll up their knees and they double time and line up in front of us. And you know, big, beautiful guys, shiny silver wings and shiny jump boots with the pants, blouse. Only paratroopers were allowed to do that during World War II. And the officer comes by and says, now listen, this is the United States Parachute Corps. He said, and we're looking for a few good men. You have to have had your 19 weeks, your 4 weeks, your 2 weeks of infantry training. Who wants a volunteer? And we went, well, but throw yourself out of an airplane. He says, there's $50 extra month jump pay. They took seven of us and back to Fort Benning now. You know, Fort Benning had the infantry school that I graduated from now. I go back to Fort Benning for parachute training. And it's an adventure like you wouldn't believe, and we gobbled it up. We loved it. The kind of training we got for airborne units, it was just absolutely fantastic. And when you're going to make your first jump, you have to make 5 jumps, 4 daylight and 1 night jump, and then that next morning you get your wings, and you're a graduate, and you become that. And we just breezed through it, gobbled it up, when we came out of jump school, we had so much confidence in ourselves. The way they built us, we were ready to take on a whole damn German army by ourselves.
After finishing up training in the South, but before shipping off to England, Speranza made good on a promise to his fellow paratroopers. Well, actually his mother did.
While we were in Fort Benning training, for doing our parachute training, the army fed us. And every once in a while, they would feed us what they called spaghetti. To every self-righteous Italian who knows what spaghetti is supposed to taste like, this stuff was a... And I used to complain and I'd say to the guys, listen, you call us spaghetti. If we're ever anywhere near New York, I'll take you to my mother's house and let you taste some real spaghetti. Well, the way it works out, we get sent to Fort Shanks, New York, just before going overseas. And, all right, Speranza, what about all the stuff you're going to take us home and let us taste real spaghetti? And I said, oh, okay, let me call my mother. You know, Camp Shanks is only like an hour and 45 minutes from my mother's house. And I called, I said, Ma, you know, like I'm going to be given a day pass. I can come home for the day and so on before I go on. And she said, Vinny, come home, I'll cook you a nice dinner. I said, Ma, listen, when we were in camp, and they used to give us stuff, nagiapara in Italian, I used to say to the guys, if we're ever near New York, I'm going to let them come home and taste real spaghetti. She said, sure, Vinny, how many? I said, 18. She said, 18. You know, one stick is 18 men. That was my unit, and they all wanted and expected to come. She said, how much time have I got? I said, we won't be there for another 3-4 hours or so. She said, plenty, don't worry. And my 4 sisters, saying, they're listening in on the phone. Yeah, I better bring all these nice young guys to the house. The neighborhood, by the way, is going crazy. They see 3 cars pull up. And 18 guys, all paratroop unit, right into my mother's house. My mother's house is a small house, And she had the tables all set up nice to that. Planks between 2 chairs for seating, but they had seating for the 20 people that were going to be there. And before everybody sat down, she pulled me aside. She said, Penny, listen, we always have wine when we have spaghetti, but... You kids are all age. The drinking age is 21. What am I going to do? I said, hey, we're going to fight for the country. Yeah, we could put the wine out too. Consequently, there was a pitcher of wine at each table. And consequently, there was 18 guys who were feeling real good, and we were getting a little nosy and boisterous and so on. And then we decided to put on a demonstration jump out my mother's living room window. The neighborhood went crazy seeing guys jumping out the window, hollering, Geronimo, run around, come back in the house, Geronimo, run out the window. And it was a fun thing. And we had a lot to talk about on the ship on the way over.
By the time Speranza got to Europe, the Allies had already made the D-Day landings and had just suffered defeat in Holland. He joined the 101st Airborne, as it was still nursing those wounds.
Now, in the meantime, the market garden operation was a complete failure. The 101st and the 82nd lost all kinds of men. They were almost captured. And they left a lot of their equipment there and so on and so on. And the 101st Airborne Division was now in Camp Mormelon, northern France, and it was supposed to be given 90 days of rest, rehabilitation, replacements, and food and ammunition. And I reached them in November, near the end of November. And by the way, when you're a replacement in an experienced outfit, you are nothing. Until you prove yourself in combat, nobody talks to you, nobody, then some of them like me feeling sorry for me because the new kids are the first to get killed all the time anyway, and they don't want to bother making you a friend. But of course, once you prove yourself in combat, you can't believe the embrace.
When we come back, the 101st Airborne Division gets quickly shuttled to the front lines in the Battle of the Bulge. And later, Vincent Speranza plays a critical role in the battle and also becomes famous for a rare funny moment at the Bulge. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this is Veterans Chronicles. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Our guest in this edition is Vincent Speranza. He's a U.S. Army veteran of World War II, and fought at the Battle of the Bulge. And that is exactly where we pick up Mr. Speranza's story, with the very sudden orders for thousands of ill-equipped soldiers to move quickly to Bastogne to stop Germany's massive counteroffensive.
3 weeks after I got there, one morning, it was actually December the 17th, the barrack lights come on. Hey! Drop your... and grab your socks. We're moving up. He said, you're crazy. The ground's frozen. We'll all break our legs. He said, you're not jumping. You're going up in trucks. All my training, all my parachute jumps, all that. I'm going to make my friends jump off the back of a truck. And then from all over the barracks, you hear people yelling. Sarge, I don't have a helmet. Sarge, I didn't get a rifle yet. Sarge, I don't have this. Later on, they told us that the figures were 10% of us were unarmed. I was a machine gunner without a machine gun. I had a trench knife in my boot. When we got to Bastogne, that was my weapon. And the sergeant says, stop bitching. Get a piece of paper and make a list. We'll stop along the way and get what you need. And we believed it. We said, okay. So we took a piece of paper. I said, I need a light 30 caliber machine gun and at least 4 or 5 boxes of ammunition. So the other guys read the helmet down. And, of course, there was no stopping. All day and all night in the open truck, and the temperature dropped to zero, and we didn't have our winter clothes issued to us yet. So we still had the summer clothes, just an unlined field jacket, and no galoshes. And after, you don't know how much cursing went on about this.
There was no role for parachuting into the Battle at the Bulge, and that was disappointing enough for Speranza. Far worse, in his estimation, was having to trade in his paratrooper boots for the ones used by the infantry.
They made us turn in our jump boots and gave us these new combat boots. Now, supposedly, the theory behind it was, hey, in combat, you know, lacing, and what they learned in Normandy and Holland is a thing there. They wanted a boot that was easier to put on and rub in cold hands and so on. Now, the problem, though, the jump boot only laced up to here, and then it had a leather flap that pulled over here with two buckles. And so you could lace it quickly, flap it over. But the leather on those, you know, jump boots are waterproof. Even if you could just put a little bacon grease on them and so on, they keep your feet dry. The combat boots had the leather turned the other way around. And when that got wet, it stayed wet. The actual fact was, we lost almost as many men to frozen feet and trench foot and so on in Bastogne as we did bombs and bullets.
As mentioned, the 101st was poorly armed since personnel shipped out so quickly to the front after being on furlough. The problem was solved, but only because the Germans were routing American forces.
The Ardennes line there was being held by four American infantry divisions, 4th, 28th, 128th, and the 9th Armored. The Germans smashed them, destroyed them as fighting units. And a lot of those troops, you know, were green troops, some of them just off the boat, some of them old, tired outfits that were sent up there for rest. The Ardennes were supposed to be a quiet sector of the war. The stragglers were ordered to the rear, and they had to go through Bastogne to get to the rear. And they were going out, and we were coming in, and so we just went up and said, hey, buddy, look, you're going back, you don't need it. We took the rifle right off his shoulder. You got any grenades? We went in their pockets and picked up grenades and so on. Those of us that were unarmed were armed before the first fight from the stragglers that came through. And I found a guy with a nice light 30 machine gun. I told him, it looks so heavy, if you let me help you carry it. And I got a gun, but I also picked up an M1 because I only had two belts of ammunition. Two belts of ammunition, the first 5 minutes of a fight. I had a machine gun, two belts of ammunition, and an M1 and a bandolier for the first fight.
For Speranza and many others, the first order of business was digging foxholes and getting ready for the Germans to come at them. But between the frigid weather and the ever-changing orders, getting settled in proved to be elusive.
We walk into the town, and the town is a mess. So the old folks trying to get out, and our guys trying to get in, and these mixed signals of the vehicles and so on. The first out of town was the 501. And our colonel, Ewell, was told, go out along the Longville Road and develop the situation. They had no intent. They didn't know what was going on. All they knew was that the Germans were out there in force. They didn't know that 25 divisions with a 1,000 of their newest tanks, the Mark IVs, the Tiger Royals, and so on, and fully equipped and so on and so on. We had 73 tanks, and we had no winter clothes, and we had only half supplies of food, ammunition, the lead elements were going to come from the Longville Road, you know, the Germany from the east end coming in, and the 501 was put right there where they were going to smash into each other. Of course, again, nobody knows how many were that, but the 501, and I was dug in near a place called Mont. It was just a few thousand yards out of Bastogne, a crossroads really with a couple of houses, and dig a hole. You know, the ground's frozen. Whack it, bounces back in your face, and you whack it, and you whack it, and you whack it, and finally, you get a hole dug. Then there's the tree roots in the Ardennes. It took us 4 hours, and you know, we had to dig a two-man hole from a machine gun and an assistant. even though I was by myself in there. And we had had no food or water since we left the trucks. And by about 4 o'clock in the morning, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, we had a whole dog flopped in it, dying, waiting to hear that somebody was going to bring us a drink of water and something to eat. And start coming out. All right, we're moving out. Oh, my God, we got to go digging over there. You pick up your gun, you're half dead, you out there, and you dig what was a sorry excuse for a foxhole, and flop in it, and you're just about ready to fall asleep from exhaustion. And you kind of say, no, we're moving out again.
When we come back, Speranza makes a major impact on the battle and becomes a legend because of beer. Stay with us. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this is Veterans Chronicles. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Our guest in this edition is Vincent Speranza, a U.S. Army veteran of World War II and the Battle of the Bulge. After all the moving around and digging, Speranza and his machine gun were finally in place. And even he could never have anticipated what would happen next.
Now it's daybreak, and there's fog. Oh, and you couldn't see anything. And then it lifts like a blanket all at once, like the fog starts to lift, so you can see all the way out there. And out in front of me was like an open field, a narrow open field, woods on both sides. And I said, you mean the cocky bastards are going to attack across an open field? You know, we don't know what they've got yet, and so on, the tanks. And so we're waiting. And the fog lifts, and when it lifts high enough for you to be able to see the man, the whole world exploded. Everything, all around. Bombs, big gun artillery, mortars, machine guns. The ground shook. You could do nothing but stick your head. The sergeants are all yelling, keep your head down, keep your head down, keep your head down. We didn't need much encouragement for that. And you just sat there waiting and feeling the ground tremble when one lives near your foxhole, the place, and this is your first combat. We're going to see now what you're made of. And the next thing, the artillery slows down a little bit, and we hear what an infantryman hates to hear the most, the grind of 88s on the tanks, and the tanks pop out of the woods. Where I was, 4. And they like lined up like the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and that's what they were. And they were firing point blank into the foxholes. The artillery by this time now had rolled over us and was past us and heading for the back part of the line. And when he hits the foxhole, the guy disappears and the rifle goes floating around down. But you didn't have time to look about or get scared or something. The German infantry is coming up. I swear, and some of the other guys said the same thing. It looked like they were romping, that they had just smashed 4 American divisions and destroyed them into nothing. And they didn't know the 101st Airborne Division was in. They expected to do the same thing there. We're dying. They're coming up. And he says, you set the sights for 400 yards. When they were 800 yards out, they started in. He wanted to wait till the ground sloped up a little bit. But there's snow all over the place. The tanks are now past. And as the infantry comes up, when they got to the 400-yard mark, man, what a surprise they got. We slaughtered them. We opened up with everything we had. You know, rifles, machine guns, bazookas, that's all paratroopers have. It's not nice to say, but it was machine gunner's delight. I earned the nickname Curse and Traverse Speranza. They said, of course, I wasn't aware of it. They said, all you did was curse and curse and curse. But you were putting those three-second bursts in there just right, man, just right. You were slaughtering them in line the way you're supposed to. We never heard such curse in our whole lives. We think you invented some new ones. Well, at any rate, the shock reverberated through the whole German land. They turned around, went back. Now the tanks, when the infantry's not behind them, they had to turn around and go back. On their way back, McCullough's artillery screamed.
But as effective as Speranza was, the Germans kept coming, and the American casualties began piling up.
When their first attack failed, that first day, that night they slipped around on both sides and surrounded us. They surrounded us, and in doing that, they captured the field hospital. Our field hospital was in the rear. And all of the beds and blankets and equipment and morphine and so was now in German hands. They shot the American personnel. They saved five of our doctors to serve in their army. One doctor and one Belgian nurse escaped into the town. And so for that whole battle of the 8 days, our medical team was one doctor, one Belgian nurse, and only his own personal equipment, instruments. They had captured everything else. The town had been flattened twice. The only buildings in the place was that still had walls were the church and the seminary across the street from the church. They had, you know, stone, brick and stone. And we had no place to put the wounded, except throw them on the floor of the church. You know, the movies show you cots and not this right. The guys were thrown on the floor of the church. We were sent through the houses that were still around, and drapes and curtains and bedspreads and door blankets, anything we could find to wrap the wounded guys in.
And it was Speranza's concern for one of those wounded soldiers that led him to making the famed beer run of Bastogne.
I said, "Well, that's great, Joe. Listen, I got to go back. Anything I can do for you before I leave?" He said, "Yeah, go find me something to drink." I said, "Joe, where the hell am I going to find you something to drink? We're surrounded and cut off. There's no supplies, nothing coming in here." He said, "Go look in the taverns." "Joe, the taverns are all bombed. Go look in the taverns." He said, "You might get lucky. Hey, your foxhole buddy wants a drink? I'm going to go find him a drink." Now, you got to get the picture. It's snowing. Not the gentle sort of, the kind with the wind blowing, the cut in your face sounds almost like on your face. Artillery is dropping in artificially all around the church and sometimes around the seminary and drone, sporadically, you know. And I'm slopping down the road looking for a tavern. Doorway to doorway, finally found one, and when I went there was nothing, all broken glass, everything all... Second tavern I went into still had a bar, and when I pulled the beer handle, beer came out. I looked around for a bottle of glass, something to put the beer in, nothing. And I my helmet, the same helmet you use in the foxhole, you know. I swished a little snow in it. I filled it up with beer. Back to Joe, "Joe, I got some beer." And he said, "Whoa!" So he says, "Excuse me," and I'm feeding him beer from the helmet. "Hey, give me some of that. Hey, give me some of that. Hey, give me some of that. Give me some of that." I ran out. Joe says, "Go get some more." "Jesus Christ, go get some more." I go down, fill up the helmet again. This time, as soon as I stepped out the door of the tavern, a shell landed nearby, knocked me down, spilled half of the beer, but it didn't hurt me. I got up and I went back to the church with the beer. Standing in the doorway like this is the regimental surgeon, our one doctor, Major Walkman. He said, "What the hell do you think you're doing, soldier? You're bringing aid and comfort to the wounded?" He said, "You stupid jackass, don't you know I got chest cases and stomach in there? You give them beer, you'll kill them. Get out of here before I have you shot." Yes, sir. And put that helmet on.
Decades later, Vincent Speranza returned to Bastogne with his daughter, and two big surprises were in store. First, the locals stunned him by escorting him to a very specific place he never thought could be found.
In 2009, when I first went back to Bastogne for the first time, when I made that decision to get involved, we meet this big Dutch paratrooper who practically lifted me off the ground and hugged me. Where have you been? You're with the 101st Airborne Division during the war. We've been trying to find you. There's so few of you left. We want to honor you. Who are you with? I said, H Company, 501. He said, you know, we studied the war every day. Who was where? What we did? He said, I can take you out to where H Company was dug in. I said, really? My daughter was with me. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, get in the car. And he and a friend of his, a Belgian tank commander, they drive out to this place. Now, I recognize nothing. You know, during the war, there's snow. There's no landscape, really, you know. And then 75 years of growth or whatever it was. But he shows me. Now, they were filled in, but you could see that they were foxholes. H Company was dug in here, 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 and on the ridge right there. And then he looks me in the eye like this and he says, and that one was your foxhole. I said, get out of here, stop jerking, stop pulling my leg. I can understand you knowing where H Company was, but how the hell do you know that was my foxhole? He said, because your company commander, Captain Stanley, when he turned in his after-action report, he had a rough diagram of where he put the automatic weapons. You were the only machine gunner in the 3rd Platoon, right? Yeah, the other guy got killed. Look, MG, you. Now, you got to picture this. You're 85 years old. You're just giving up your wife. The guy's telling you, you know where you're standing right here now? 72 years ago, you were a 19-year-old kid with a machine gun waiting for the first German attack. Well, you know, when you're 85, you don't have control anymore. I fell apart. Everything that I had put back here came back and hit me in the face like a cement block.
But Speranza also had a big surprise for the people in Bastogne. The beer run was real.
And when it was my turn, I told them the beer story. While I'm telling the story, they're going, you? You were the GI who brought beer and helmet? I said, yeah. You, the wounded on the floor of the church, you gave him beer? I said, yeah. I said, man, don't you know you're famous in Europe? And I said, what the hell are you talking about? They said, waiter, come here. Bring us 4 bottles of airborne beer. And the waiter comes back on a tray. He's got 4 bottles of beer and 4 little ceramic bowls in the shape of a GI helmet that they serve it in. And the label on the bottle of beer shows an American paratrooper with a helmet full of beer going like this. Nobody thought that was a true story. That was just one of those World War II exaggerated baloney stories. They said a Belgian brewer about 20 years ago who heard the story said, well, let's honor this mythical GI. And he said, we can't believe it. It's a true story. And the guy, I said, yeah, maybe I should get a cut on the beer, right? And they said, no. Well, they gave me 6 bottles of beer to take home when I went home. When I went home, my newspaper, the state, my newspaper called and said, we heard a story about you, could we come interview you? And I said, sure. And they came with a photographer. So the reporter got the story, and the photographer set up the 6 bottles of beer, like on the counter, with me behind it. It took a picture of, you know, the airborne beer and the Speranza. And the next day, they put it on the front page of the newspaper. Somebody took it from the newspaper and put it on the internet. I don't know how many million hits it has now, but I will repeat my original adage. I am more famous for what I did with a helmet full of beer than what I did with my machine gun the whole war. And I'm heavily medaled. I got 2 Bronze Stars, 2 Purple Hearts. French Legion of Honor, Belgian Order of Gear, the Dutch Order of Honor. They got 1 million medals What does anybody want to hear? Hey, Speranza, tell us the beer story.
Vincent Speranza, a U.S. Army veteran of World War II and the Battle of the Bulge, and the perpetrator of the very real beer run of Bastogne. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this is Veterans Chronicles. Hi, this is Greg Corumbus, and thanks for listening to Veterans Chronicles, a presentation of the American Veterans Center. For more information, please visit AmericanVeteransCenter.org. You can also follow the American Veterans Center on Facebook and on Twitter, we're at AVC Update. Subscribe to the American Veterans Center YouTube channel for full oral histories and special features. And of course, please subscribe to the Veterans Chronicles podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and please join us next time for Veterans Chronicles.